I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance today. Clerk Assistant, would you take the roll, please?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Szymanski?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Cornish? Representative Gruenhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesch? Representative Liebling? Representative Mazerol?
Here.
Representative Moline?
Oh, here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Present.
And Representative Wardlow?
Did you say Representative Champion?
That's why I was thrown off.
Oh, you don't want me to be here this morning?
Representative Champion?
I'm here. I wanted my time in the sun's light.
I didn't get called in public safety about a week ago, and I was prepared to leave, too.
Okay.
All right, Chair notes that we do have a quorum. The minutes from the last meeting are in the packet. May I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Representative Kreisel moves the meeting, the minutes of March 3rd. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of approval signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we're going to take up all of the bills today. If we do not get done this morning, we are going to recess until approximately 4:30 or call of the chair. We'll make that determination when we get to the end of the meeting as well. So for right now, what?
I just have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you intend to vote on all of these bills, or do you intend to lay some of them over, or
Good question. I was getting to that. Thank
Sorry,
you for
Mr. Chair.
That's fine. We're going to be looking at laying over at least three. One goes to public safety. That's the HF 229. Representative Kreisel's bill 361 is targeted for the general register, as is Kahn's bill 479. This particular bill we're dealing with right first, Representative Slocum, motion will be to re-refer to public safety. So we're going to lay some over and for further discussion. Representative Slocum, if you'd have a seat at the table. Chair would like to bring House File 642 before the committee, and therefore I'll move the bill that be recommended to pass be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance. Representative Slocum, before you start, I believe you have two witnesses, is that correct? May I see the hands of the parties who intend to testify for the bill? Is there anyone present who's going to testify against the bill? Let me see a hand for purposes of scheduling timing here. All right, Representative Slocum, you go ahead.
First, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for hearing this bill. In the essence of not wanting you to have to come back at 4:30, this is pretty straightforward. I have an amendment that was brought to me by the sheriff's organization. And
Representative Slocum, let's do this. To get the bill in the shape you want, I'll let you discuss it. But first, let's get it attached to the bill. And the chair, therefore, moves the Amendment A11 to House File 642. Hearing no discussion, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Your bill is now amended. So go ahead.
Okay, this is a very simple, straightforward bill. It says that if a child is to be tried as an adult, until that trial occurs, the child would be housed in a juvenile facility. The statistics bear out that if you put a child into an adult facility, that child's going to pretty much be there the rest of their life. It's not good statistics, because an adult facility is a different venue, shall we say, than a juvenile facility. So this bill just says we're going to house that juvenile in a juvenile facility until their trial. And I have testifiers.
Let's hear your testimony.
I have Captain Mike Rush.
Welcome, Captain Rush. Give us your name. for the record, and then please go forward.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Captain Michael A. Resch, W-R-E-S-H, and members of the committee. I am the facility commander of the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office Jail. The jail is an 839-bed facility, staffed and designed to detain individuals 18 years of age and older. Our jail is the only American Corrections Association accredited facility in the state and has an average daily population of 685 inmates, majority adults, who are awaiting trial and sentencing. In 2010, we housed an average of 6 youthful offenders, 18 and under, in the jail at any given time. Under current rules and regulations, when a juvenile is certified to stand trial as an adult, the juvenile is required to be kept in our adult jail until they face trial or sentencing. House File 642 will allow judges and sheriffs the ability to house these juvenile offenders in a juvenile facility pending their trial and adjudication. This would allow us to better manage our facility and improve efficiency while maintaining public safety. Let me briefly explain why. The American Corrections Association is an organization nationally recognized for identification of best practices in detention and corrections. According to the ACA, youthful offenders housed in adult jail should be afforded specialized accommodations and services, including sight and sound separation from adult inmates, direct supervision in housing units, classification and programming plans to account for the physical, mental, social, and education needs of the youthful offender, case management plans, food service, daily nutritional requirements over adults, medical issues involving parents or guardians. The Sheriff's Office jails currently provide specialized accommodations and service to its youthful offenders, but as mentioned above, it comes with undue burden both financially and operationally to the Sheriff's Office. Additionally, a recent federal court case requires the local school district to provide teachers and educational opportunities to juvenile offenders who are being held in the adult facility. Providing for educational needs of youthful offenders in the jail is particularly costly and operationally difficult. Currently, high school classes are provided to youthful offenders in the jail by the Minneapolis School District Stadium View. In 2010, the Sheriff's Office resorted to using office-based classrooms to conduct these classes. Simply because youthful offenders are being prosecuted as adults does not detract from the fact that they are still under 18 years of age. Rules, laws, and standards for detention of youthful offenders are significantly different from those for adult offenders 18 and over. The level of socialization of youthful offenders while in jail is greatly restricted. Youthful offenders in jail are here for only serious felonies, and as a result of their length of stay is oftentimes measured in months. It is not uncommon for youthful offenders to have one or two other inmates to interact with during their stay. Female youthful offenders are even more greatly impacted. It is extremely rare that the Sheriff's Office jail detains more than one female youthful offender at any given time, resulting in that one youthful offender being segregated with virtually no opportunities for socialization at all. Again, in passing this legislation, judges and sheriffs will have the ability to house these youthful offenders awaiting trial in a juvenile facility in a more efficient way. In Hennepin County, the 123-bed juvenile facility is operated by the Hennepin County Department of Community Corrections and Rehabilitation. The juvenile center, just one block west of the Metrodome, is designed to provide the services and accommodations needed for youthful offenders and has the resources to appropriately provide for their needs. In the juvenile center, youthful offenders can be served by one set of teachers and escorted throughout the building without the restrictions in place they would have in the adult jail due to the safety and security concerns and welfare of the juvenile. This bill will offer judges and the sheriffs the flexibility to house most of the prisoners who have been certified as adults in a juvenile facility. Juveniles housed with juveniles, adults housed with adults. This does not mean that juveniles cannot be housed in the adult jail. It means it provides administrators the flexibility to provide most of these offenders with adequate and safe housing, education, and programming without having to provide duplicative services just a few blocks away. The legislation will create more efficient overall operation and provide the needs for youthful offenders. We, both Hennepin County Sheriff's Office and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, ask for your support. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association has issued a letter in their support. Jerry Dreesen from Hennepin County Community Corrections is here with me today, too, to answer any questions anyone might have, too, in regards to this change.
Any questions from the committee at this time? Captain Resch, if you'd stay with us, but have a seat.
I have one more testifier, if you will indulge.
Jim Grathwall, Minneapolis Public Schools.
Thank you.
Come forward. Give us your name and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jim Grathwall with the Minneapolis Public Schools. I think in 13 years working with Minneapolis Schools, this is my first opportunity to visit with the Judiciary Committee, so I'd like to thank the author for bringing the bill forward. And just let you know, we're out on record in support of the bill. As we enter into the season of Lent, or at least Christians, we're reminded of biblical injunctions to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and visit the sick and those in prison. It's probably not a surprise that we do that in public schools with free and reduced lunch programs, generally provide hats and mittens and jackets for kids that come into school, provide educational services to those in care and treatment, and as you see in the bill before you, provide educational programs for adults and juveniles that are awaiting adjudication. We support the bill because this amendment really allows us to do that fourth piece, the educational program, in the juvenile detention center much more effectively. As Captain Resch pointed out, in our current configuration, providing educational services to juveniles certified as adults is really inefficient for us. If we can do those juveniles in the juvenile detention center, there's better space, it's more efficient for us, and it's a better educational setting for all the students. I think I'll leave it there. Happy to entertain any questions, and again, thank the author for bringing the bill forward.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, any questions from the committee? Is there anyone here that wants to testify in opposition to this bill? All right. Any discussion at this point? Captain Resch, do you know Detention Deputy Ryan Smith?
Yes, I do.
Give him my best when you see him.
I will do that.
Thank you. All right. If there's no further discussion on this bill, Representative Slocum, Chair is going to renew his motion that the bill, House File 642, as amended, be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you for this good
Thank
bill.
Thank you.
All right. Chair would now like to bring House File 361 before the committee. Representative Kriesel, want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 361 pass and be re-referred to the general schedule or general register.
General register. That's the motion. Representative Kriesel, go ahead. You have, before you start, do you have three testifiers scheduled? I believe you do.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify in opposition to this bill? May I see hands at this time? I see nobody wishing to testify in opposition. Representative Kriesel, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. I'm here to present House File 361, which would modify the crime of fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle when death or bodily injury results from the attempt to flee. This bill would include situations where a suspect starts to flee in a motor vehicle but abandons that vehicle and continues to flee using other means. Fleeing a peace officer is such a reckless and dangerous act that puts many innocent lives at risk. This bill will punish those that make this choice and cause harm and deter others from fleeing in the future. I'm proud to carry this bill, and I would appreciate your support. I have people here to testify that have been personally affected by fleeing suspects.
Thank you, Representative Kriesel. And would your first testifier please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
My name is Ann M. Deneen, and I am a patrol sergeant with the Minneapolis Park Police. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. On behalf of my department, Mark Bedard's friends, co-workers, and the citizens of Minneapolis, we are grateful for your time, and I'd like to especially thank Representative Creasel's sponsoring of this bill. On November 1st, 2007, Officer Mark Bedard was fatally injured during a foot pursuit in Minneapolis. Mark was chasing suspects involved in two separate drive-by shootings in front of two different schools that day. Mark collided with a squad car and died as a result of his injuries on November 9, 2007. The two offenders whose actions set into motion the events that led to Officer Bedard's death were charged with and pled to felony drive-by shooting. Their sentences were less than 4 years each, and in fact, one party is already released this summer. The second party is scheduled for release next month. Because of their actions on November 1, 2007, Mark Bedard has been dead for 3 years. The current flee on foot statute does not address penalties for causing serious harm or death to others if pursuit of a felonious criminal goes from vehicle to foot. This is a loophole easily remedied by this bill. It wasn't until 1997 that fleeing in a motor vehicle became a felony. Fleeing on foot became a misdemeanor in 2005. Our intention is not to make every foot chase a felony. Rather, we are asking that the state repair the gap between when the crime of fleeing starts in a motor vehicle and moves to a foot chase and holding those responsible accountable for their actions from start to finish when it directly causes harm. This correction is for all citizens of Minnesota, not just Mark Bedard. However, Mark's death is what made us aware of the problem that existed when it came time to charge those responsible for his death. People flee on foot for all sorts of reasons, and in pursuing these criminals, innocent citizens as well as law enforcement lives are in jeopardy. When a pursuit ends with the occupant still in the car, they can be charged for all the harm they have caused by their actions. If it occurs after they bail from the vehicle and are captured on foot, the accountability is non-existent. In Minneapolis last year, approximately 136 motor vehicle flees. There were 136 motor vehicle flees, 56 of which ended in a crash and foot chase. One crash had a two-year-old in the vehicle, the suspect's vehicle, and they fled. We are asking that you please consider this proposed legislation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sergeant. Representative Creasel. Mr. Bedard, identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Bedard, and the proposed bill that I'm here to testify about is the direct result of the death of my brother, Mark Bedard. Mark was the Minneapolis police officer killed in November of 2007. While on patrol, he responded to a drive-by shooting in North Minneapolis that led to a car chase. The suspects crashed and fled on foot. My brother chased the driver and was accidentally hit responding to the scene, was accidentally hit by a squad car responding to the scene to provide backup. He was rushed to North Memorial Hospital and spent the next 10 days fighting for his life. My family was forced to make an extremely difficult decision, and on November 9, 2007, he passed away. He left behind a wife and three-year-old son. Mark spent over 10 years protecting the citizens of Minneapolis and made the ultimate sacrifice. My family and I have spent the last 3 years dealing with his death and trying to put our lives back together. One of the most frustrating aspects surrounding Mark's death was the absolute failure of the criminal justice system. The people responsible for Mark's death were never held accountable. After the suspects were arrested, my sister-in-law and I met with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. They informed us because Mark was killed as a result of injuries sustained during a foot chase and not a motor vehicle chase, they were not able to charge the suspects with the crime. In the state of Minnesota, it's only a misdemeanor to flee police on foot, regardless of the outcome of the chase. In the months following Mark's death, it became abundantly clear that something had to be done to ensure this injustice would not be repeated. How can a police officer be killed in line of duty and no one's held accountable? Minneapolis Park Police Sergeant Ann Dineen, a co-worker and close friend of Mark's, contacted the Hennepin County Attorney's Office regarding our desire to pass a law that would hold people accountable for fleeing police on foot. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman was gracious enough to allow Hennepin County Attorney David Brown to assist us in our efforts. Mr. Brown drafted a bill that would enhance penalties for people that decide to flee police on foot. The bill was introduced in 2009, but due to time restraints, did not become a law. I realize there is nothing I can do to bring my brother back. However, the unfortunate reality is that at some point another person will be killed or seriously injured as a result of a suspect's decision to flee police on foot. At a minimum, we feel this law would help provide future families with a sense of justice and hopefully help ease their pain. Thank you.
Mr. Bedard, I'm sorry for your personal loss. Thank you for coming here today and testifying. I'd like to call now on behalf of the bill as well, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney David Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, for the record, I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney David Brown. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill and Representative Kreisel for bringing it forward. As Mike said, this is a bill that was brought forth 2 years ago. That bill was much broader. We heard concerns about expanding the scope of all foot chase fleeings, and so the bill you have before you is significantly narrowed from that. This only would penalize those fleeings that begin in motor vehicles, and those are the ones that our law enforcement people have told us are particularly dangerous. They describe it as mayhem, both in front of the car, and what we're starting to see even more frequently are people bailing out of the cars with the car still going. So putting pedestrians, bicyclists, other motorists in danger with this vehicle that's still going, and there's nobody in it. And unfortunately, once they bail out, they're no longer fleeing in a motor vehicle. And so the idea behind this bill was to hold them accountable for those most serious kinds of fleeings without overly expanding the bill. With that, I will thank you all for your consideration. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions from the committee of the proponents of the bill? Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, I seem to recall asking you this question 2 years ago when this came up with Representative Olin, and I can't remember the answer, so I'm going to ask you again. Why is it that common law felony murder rule prohibits you from charging murder in these cases?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The case is State v. Craven. The Mantoo Craven was the crook who was fleeing in that case. If you look at it, it's a Court of Appeals decision from 2001. And what they said was because fleeing in a motor vehicle is a specific crime, you can't use the general felony murder rule. So if it doesn't fit into the fleeing in a motor vehicle, you can't charge it. The case is State v. Craven. I have the cite for you if you'd like to read it yourself. But what they've essentially said is in those cases where we have a specific crime, you can't use felony murder.
Okay, so
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Brown, then, just so I can understand this, what would be a case and an example where we could use it then?
Mr. Brown.
Representative Lash, we use a number of underlying felonies for felony murder. Second degree assault is the most common. That's pointing a gun at somebody, which is a more generalized intent, but they have said that is the sufficient basis for felony murder. You're pointing a gun at somebody and the gun goes off. You are on the hook for felony murder. But in this case, what they held was, and it was specific to fleeing in a motor vehicle, you can't use it as the basis for felony murder, and that's partly why we're here. It was partly why Pete Orpett, who was the prosecutor in the Bedard case, who's now the Washington County attorney, was so frustrated with his inability to go forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take a look at the case.
Very good. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, a few things pop to my mind. First of all, my condolences as well for your brother's death. I mean, you know, it's we know that police officers do a tremendous service for us, and they put themselves on the line every day. And you know, it hurts all of us when one of our great officers is killed in the line of duty, and there is no way to get around that. But, you know, first of all, then this is the first I've heard about this particular bill, but I understood you to say, first of all, that your brother was hit by a police car in the course of this. So, and you're nodding yes, so I got that part right. So, you know, these kinds of cases are very difficult because, and I think we've heard in this committee before, that something terrible happens and after the fact people say, well, gosh, we couldn't charge a serious enough crime. We didn't get the sort of penalty that this person deserved because of the harm that they did. But I'm not sure that this bill really fixes that problem or is appropriate anyway. And And so any of the testifiers could answer this or respond to this. What I'm hearing is that under this bill, a person who, say, begins to flee in a car, and, you know, let's face it, a lot of people who flee in motor vehicles are probably drunk to begin with. That's probably probably many of the times they're trying to avoid getting a DUI by just getting out of there. If they suddenly say to themselves, this is not a good thing, I'm putting people in danger, and they then stop the car and bail out and run in order to even perhaps mitigate the danger of fleeing in a car, you're saying now that we're going to treat them as if they didn't bail out. So I'm wondering if we aren't perhaps incentivizing people or disincentivizing them from making a better decision by stopping the flight in a car and getting out and going on foot, assuming that they are intent on getting away. Could somebody respond to that?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that is not a fact scenario that our law enforcement officers see very frequently from my discussions with them. These people are not taking the time to stop the car and mitigate the danger. What they're doing is bailing out sometimes at speed to get out of there. And what it doesn't take into account is the fleeing has provoked both officers behind the vehicle trying to pursue them, and frankly, if they have time, officers in front of the vehicle trying to stop that vehicle. And what we have are these, even if the officers aren't pursuing at high speed, people trying to get away at high speed, and this incredibly dangerous scenario. Now, to go to your question about the Bedard case itself, we still have to prove causation, that the fleeing caused the injury. Would we have been able to prosecute the Bedard case that way? I don't know the answer to that. But what it brought to light in looking at this problem was the number of cases where these are bailing out without parking the car safely in the middle of 35W and running across lanes of traffic, endangering our officers, endangering our pedestrians, endangering other motorists. And it was those fleeings that start in the cars that were particularly dangerous. So that's really what we're focused on here. And understand that the state always has the burden of proving that element of causation beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then secondly, you know, I have asked before in this committee on other bills, and you know, I want to ask you as well, you know, in this very difficult fiscal time that we're in, and we hear from our courts that they are just overwhelmed and can, you know, it's a very dire situation really in the courts. So I think it's really important when we look at these kinds of bills to ask ourselves what public safety bang for the buck do we really get here? And so, you know, is there any data to show from other states or wherever it might come from that increasing this penalty on the books is going to actually prevent this behavior? Or is it just that after the fact we're going to be able to feel better because we can give punishment that we think is more deserved? Is this going to actually prevent any tragedy from occurring?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we know from the testimony in the Public Safety Committee that the fiscal note, I believe, was zero. So in terms of burdening the courts, what we find with this kind of a case is they don't occur very often, but when they do, it merits a strong response. And I believe the availability of that strong response in the correct case does deter crime. It does make people think twice.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, on a different bill, I asked a police officer pretty much that same question, and he said, well, he doesn't want to get into the minds of the people who commit these crimes. I mean, you know, so you're saying, well, you think it will make people think twice. I mean, is in your experience, do people think about what's on the statute books before they commit a crime?
Mr. Brown, on the issue of deterrence.
Mr. Chair, I think the notion of our entire criminal code is that holding people accountable in the correct situation does have a deterrent effect. Now, whether that applies to any particular individual, I will join the police officer in saying I'm not going to try and get into their mind. But the whole notion of the criminal code is partly deterrence, but that's not the only goal here. holding people accountable for their wrongful conduct after the fact is an important goal. And where we're engaging in highly dangerous behavior and it causes a death, holding them accountable is a legitimate public safety interest. And I would encourage your support.
Representative Liebling, then Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, just to kind of finish this up, well, you know, I agree that holding people accountable is an important public safety goal. However, you know, in the situation we're in, I wonder if we shouldn't be focusing our efforts on, as I say, getting public safety for our very limited resources. And even though the fiscal note is zero, I mean, I think that, you know, we're again adding to what we have. You know, I believe that every time we increase penalties and so on, that we're adding to the load that the courts have. But I also just want to say that I think there's a difference. You know, I understand that people are held to know what's on the books. However, I think there's a difference between crimes where you think about it ahead of time and a crime like fleeing, where people just make a decision on the spur of the moment and they don't think about it. And that's probably the very problem that we have. They don't think about it. Either they're drunk or they're on drugs, or they're just plain not thinking clearly, so they commit these crimes. That's probably why it's, you know, doesn't form the basis of a felony murder charge. And I haven't read that case either, but I just don't think that, you know, this is the kind of thing where I think we need data to show that it's going to deter anything, not just, you know, surmise that it might, because to me it isn't the kind of crime that people would think about ahead of time, and that, in fact, is the very problem that we have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, I think it is a much better drafted bill than what I saw 2 years ago, so I appreciate that. And if I understand it correctly, this will just give you another tool in the toolbox for dealing with situations of this sort. Is that correct understanding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, that is correct. Thank you for that comment. We really did try to narrow the scope of this bill.
Any other questions? Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my condolences for the death of your brother. Mr. Brown, this bill begs this question, maybe you answered it, and unfortunately I didn't hear it, but I understand, unfortunately, that a suspect fled in a vehicle, jumped out of a vehicle, but the officer was unfortunately killed by the actions of another police officer in a vehicle. So my question is, how will this bill help address those set of circumstances that you believe to be the driving force behind this legislation?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, I'll try to be brief because I thought I did address that. Whether this bill would have allowed us to charge the fact in the Officer Bedard case, I don't know, because, again, we'd have to prove causation beyond a reasonable doubt. What talking to law enforcement and what this case brought out was the number of cases where people were bailing out and actually striking cars or coming close to hitting pedestrians and bicycles. So that became kind of the driving force. And when you see this narrowed bill, it really is tailored towards that. And in any given fact scenario, again, we have to prove that the fleeing caused the death or the injury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Any further questions of the proponents? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify in opposition to this bill, raise your hand. Anyone wishing to testify in opposition? Seeing none, the public testimony is now closed. Is there any further discussion on this bill? Any discussion? If not, then Representative Krasel, renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 361 pass and be moved to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion prevails, and the bill is recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Krasel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Chair would like to now bring forward House File 660 before the committee. Representative McDonald. And it's the chair's intent to lay this bill over, so we will not be taking a vote on it today. Chair does move House File 660. Be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee if and when it is taken off the table. Representative McDonald, go ahead. Bill is before us.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. First, I need to ask for a motion to have a
Representative
amendment.
Representative McDonald, I believe you do have an oral motion on the bill to add the letter S to the word subdivision on line 1.9. Line 1.9 of the bill, add an S to the word subdivision and change the word with to within on line 1.10. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right, to get that oral amended amendment attached, Chair would move that oral amendment. Is there any discussion on that? All those in favor, excuse me, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Your bill is amended. Go ahead.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here to bring to you House File 660. What this bill will do will reinstate a minimum of 36-month presumptive sentence for offenders receive a repeat conviction of fourth, third, second, or first degree criminal sexual assault. The problem was in 2005, the legislature enacted laws to create life sentences for some sex offenders and impose harsher sentences on repeat offenders. When the sentencing guidelines to implement these changes were enacted in 2006, the 36-month mandatory minimum for repeat offenders was repealed. It appears that it was the repeal was unintended. Nobody's perfect. The repeal of the 36-month presumptive sentence has created a gap in which some offenders who receive a repeat conviction, particularly those who commit fourth or third degree offenses, do not receive as a harsh a sentence as they should, and thus would prior to change that was made in 2006. So basically House File 660 will reinstate the language that existed in the Minnesota statutes of 609.109, subdivision 2, prior to the 2006 repeal.
All right, I believe you have, if you're done, you have two testifiers, is that correct?
Yes, thank you. I have Carolyn Palmer with us today. She's with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and also Jill Payne, who's the interim executive director for Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Whichever one wants to start, identify yourself and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Chairman Smith, Representative Johnson, and members of the committee, I'd like to just give you a little bit of information about MNCASA. We are a nonprofit organization incorporated in 1981. We represent approximately 70 sexual assault advocacy programs statewide. We support House File 660, a bill reinstating a 36-month presumptive executed sentence for repeat criminal sexual conduct offenders. MNCASA works closely with county attorney offices throughout Minnesota to support their efforts to prosecute criminal sexual offenses. Several of these prosecutors serve on MNCASA's public policy committee. They brought the repeal of 36-month presumptive sentencing to our attention shortly after it was enacted in 2006. These prosecutors, MNCASA's public policy committee, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association have consistently supported restoring the 36-month presumptive sentence as a necessary tool for addressing the repeat sex offenders they see in their courtrooms. As Representative McDonald noted, this provision did exist a few years ago, but was repealed in 2006 as part of the legislature's efforts to revise the sentencing guidelines and to establish harsher penalties for sex offenses. By all indications, the repeal was not intended. Over the past several years, MNCASA has worked with legislators trying to address a mistake that could have been easily remedied at the time it was made, had it been noticed. Over the past 4 years, previous versions of this bill have passed committees in both the House and the Senate without controversy. The only barrier we have faced in moving the bill toward law has been a relatively small fiscal note. When we first brought this legislation forward in 2007, there probably should not have been a fiscal impact assigned because no adjustment was made in the Department of Corrections budget to reflect the repeal of 36-month presumptive sentencing. Nobody had really realized it had happened at the time. But as time has passed, the appropriated funding was absorbed into the corrections-based budget, and now the restoration of this particular sentencing guideline does result in a new bed count. We would like to acknowledge Representative Lesh's assistance in the past to obtain this clarification about the bill's fiscal impact from DOC. While we recognize that any financial consequence is an important consideration, we do believe this is an instance in which a small investment will make a big difference in how the state responds to repeat sex offenders. We hope the committee will consider the history of this legislation when weighing the significance of its fiscal impact. What I would like to do now is turn over the testimony to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, Ms. Jill Payne, to explain the mechanics of this bill proposal and to answer any technical questions you might have about the sentencing guidelines. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Payne, identify yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Payne. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Our agency has no official position on House File 660. However, we are here to say that we generally believe that this repeal was inadvertent. Certainly, the bill is consistent with how sex offenders are treated under the sentencing guidelines currently. Currently, for sex offenders, there is a more severe sex offender grid now in place since 2006, where there's harsher penalties or harsher weighting for those prior sex offenses. And subsequent sex offenders or repeat sex offenders do receive a second custody status point if they have a prior sex offense. So certainly this is consistent with the sentencing guidelines currently. And just to speak to the number of offenders and the types of offenders that this bill would affect, we know that between 2007 and 2009, there were 11 repeat sex offenders that under the guidelines did not receive a recommendation for prison, and this is the population that we're talking about. There are three offenders who are second degree criminal sexual conduct offenders, and there are two that are under the criminal sexual conduct in the third degree, and six who are fourth degree offenders. These people fell within the shaded area of the grid, which means that the recommendation was that they were for probation rather than for prison. And basically the result of this is that they had a prior sex offense that they had successfully completed probation or some type of supervision for. So they were not recommended prison. Four of these 11 offenders did, however, go to prison regardless under an aggravated dispositional departure. So four of the offenders did go to prison. We believe that these people would then serve a longer sentence according to this bill. And thank you. I'm happy to try and answer any of your questions as well.
Thank you. Before we go to questions, is there anyone present who wants to testify in opposition to the bill? Raise your hand. I see none. Any questions from the committee? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify those numbers again? I'm looking for what the total number is and over how many years that was. So those numbers you gave, 11 and 3, and was that for 1 year or for the entire period since the repeal?
Ms. Payne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. It's for 3 years. It's 2007, 2008, and 2009. So there were 11 offenders over that time period. We're talking about 1% of the total criminal sexual conduct population.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Champion, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here's my question. If we're talking about this particular piece of legislation, it appears that this bill would make jail time for all of them of that 11 a presumption, as opposed to, giving the judge the discretion as to what he or she is going to do. Is that right?
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative. It would make the recommendation under the guidelines that these would be presumptive prison sentences. So if a judge so wished, they could still depart from the sentencing guidelines and place the offender on probation or other supervision. So that it's always under the discretion of the court that they can do that.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up?
Yes, Representative Champion.
I believe you so eloquently stated earlier that a part of the disposition of a couple of the offenders is that they ended up in jail by way of the court identifying aggravating circumstances by which to depart. So if that's true, can you tell us what this particular bill is going to change about a court's ability to do its work as opposed to just creating a presumption?
Ms. Payne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. That's a very good question. It would change so that the recommendation under the law and under the guidelines would be for these repeat sex offenders to go to prison rather than having the court to have to make a distinction and have findings related to why they are aggravating that person's sentence to prison. So the presumption would be that they then go to prison.
Mr. Chair, one.
Yes, Representative Champion.
And just along that line of thinking, wouldn't you agree that that causes more of a burden on the court to now be in the position to articulate the reasons why they believe a certain offender, for lack of a better word, should not, in fact, go to prison? And a second part of that question is that it appears from the bill that if the court wants to stay the execution of a sentence, it has to also now articulate conditions of probation, which appears, you know, to be different from what the court has to do today. Wouldn't you agree?
Ms. Payne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. If the bill were in place and a judge wanted to give a stayed sentence, they would have to give reasons mitigating the sentence and placing the person on probation rather than prison. So, in effect, yes, they would, rather than giving an aggravated sentence, and reasons for that aggravation, they would have to give reasons for their mitigated sentence.
Any other questions? Since there's no further testimony and no questions, the House File 660 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further action at a later time. Representative McDonald, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Committee members, thank you for your support.
We're going to go out of order at this point since Representative Kahn is here. I think we'll move on to her bill, House File 479. And Representative Kahn, have a spot at the table. Do you have any testifiers today?
I don't, Mr. Chairman.
Representative, that's good. Anyone in the audience wishing to be heard on this bill, please raise your hand now. Apparently no testimony. Representative Kahn, the chair would like to get your bill before the committee. Therefore, chair moves that House File 479 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Go ahead, Representative. Yes.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a very reasonable bill that was passed by the full legislature last session. It was passed unanimously by the Senate, and it was passed with only two dissenting votes in the House, and was then vetoed by the governor in a very strange decision. The background, for those of you who weren't here last year or weren't on Representative Cornish's committee, and I'll point out that I'm proud to have both Representative Cornish and Representative Smith as co-authors of the bill, was that a woman had been there was a raid on a woman's house who had been smoking methamphetamine in what's called a bong, or what is really called in the bill a water pipe or a controlled water use machine or something, some language like that. When I called my local bong dealer and asked him about this, he was furious, immediately jumped on me and said, we don't sell bongs at all, we only sell water pipes. So apparently that's a defamatory word, but it's sort of a simple word that people understand. So I tend to use it anyway. Anyway, they raided the house and they didn't find any supplies of drugs or anything. They just found one bong that had not, with water in it, and methamphetamine is smoked through a bong to kind of make it a better experience. Sorry, I have no experience in any of these things. To sort of mellow it out. So they confiscated the whole, the bong itself, and then they measured, and then the charge, her charge, which would have been a petty misdemeanor, then became a first grade felony because they measured the entire weight of water in the bong. Now, the major reason I was obviously drawn to this in kind of, I felt this need to defend the sloppy housewife who hadn't emptied her bong. It's kind of like not emptying your coffee pot. So I felt a certain connection to her. And the charge went through, was thrown out by the trial judge, a former Republican legislator, actually. It was thrown out by the county attorney continued. It was thrown out in the appeals court, and the Supreme Court, though, agreed with the county attorney. So we're taking a petty misdemeanor and making it into a felony. First of all, you look at the cost of going through the judicial system through this point, and then just the cost. I don't think she was jailed. I think there was some plea negotiation, but just the cost to our penal system of doing this. And it all went on whether the water was a mixture and it was part of an apparatus. And so we started with a pretty far-reaching bill, which just made, and there was objections from, we worked with the county attorney's groups, although they still do not support this, to narrow it distinctly, because they don't want to have to do a purity test on everything they confiscate from a drug dealer. And the best piece of literature, I think, that's come out of state government, and I've passed it out to all of you, is the dissent by Paul Anderson, which is just fairly ferocious language. And so I gave you the Supreme Court case, and the dissent is three times as long as the decision, I think. And so I guess I just like the bill is more narrow than possibly it should be. It really just deals with water in a bong. It also has the distinction of being, as far as I know, the only Minnesota piece of legislation that ever made it to the Daily Show with Jon Stewart. That's another thing I guess I could have brought, is I could have brought that conversation along. But I think that's available. You can get that on YouTube or going back in the archives of the Daily Show when Governor Pawlenty was on it. That was the only state issue that Jon Stewart chose to do, why he had vetoed this bill. And Governor Pawlenty said something in his defense to Jon Stewart, which I can only say was not completely true, that it would only be used in the case of the most extreme offenders. And clearly this sloppy housewife who didn't clean out her bong was clearly not a major drug deal. And the importance of the thrust behind our laws, the why weight is a criteria, is that we want to separate dealers from users. And we clearly had a case of a user, not a dealer. So I would urge that you follow the advice of your chair and also the past legislature and pass it on, and we'll see if we can get it by this governor.
Any questions from the committee of the author of the bill? Any questions? Seeing no testimony further no questions, the motion is then back before us. The chair will renew his motion that the bill be recommended to pass and that it be sent to the general register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish, House File 152. Representative Cornish, do you have any testifiers with you today?
No, I do not, sir.
All right. The chair's going to get the bill before us, House File 152. It's going to be the intention of the chair to lay it over at the end of discussion. Representative Cornish moves that House File 152 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means in the House. Anyone in the audience wishing to be heard on this bill and testify, raise your hand now. We do have one testifier after you're done. Representative Cornish, go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill came to me from an investigator in Nobles County who investigates financial crimes and other crimes. And he told me or reported to me that numerous times the law enforcement is running into problems with illegal documents. And the definition of identification document is referred to in House File 152 as claimed in Subdivision 1. And it basically is a passport, immigration visa, alien registration card, employment authorization document, birth certificate, social security card, military ID, adoption decree, marriage license, driver's license, or photo ID card. The problem is in Minnesota, statutes are real vague and they don't allow really for prosecution of these crimes directly or this the possession. Right now, our law enforcement officers are stopping people on the road and investigating crimes where we run into multiple fake IDs that are hard to tell except from an expert. Some as many as 25 with a rubber band around them, driver's license from vendors. These are a lot of these are professionally manufactured from a vendor. And basically, it's not a crime to possess them. And the statutes are vague, and they don't really refer directly to the illegal possession. So right now, they're not being able to charge these people with any real sort of crime until they actually catch them using them. This bill would make it a crime, a gross misdemeanor, to possess two or more, and three or more would be a felony. And we're talking about, once again, those ID documents. The reason we started at two or more instead of just an illegal document is to get away from the juvenile or college student or high school that goes in to buy tobacco or alcohol illegally. There really should be no good reason to carry two. I imagine that the my testifier... Oh, could we hand out those documents? No, those two. The pages will hand out two different... Okay. Or are they in the packet? Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. They already handed them out. I was too busy testifying to notice. The documents that you've been handed will show you the statutes that have been enacted in other states. You could receive testimony that there could be challenges to these. I think somebody testified to that in the past. I don't know of any challenges that currently challenged or being successful in the other states against the type of crime that I'm talking about here. And things seem to be operating well in those states with very similar statutes on the books. And, Mr. Chair and members, with that brief description, I've already heard this in the Policy Committee here before your Finance Committee because of the fiscal note. This has been an interesting fiscal note with the gross misdemeanor for two and the possession of three being a felony. We came up with a fiscal note, you'll notice, of... in 11 and 12, 12 and 13, with the fiscal note, you'll notice on the first page. And so I asked again for another fiscal note, and that's in the process if we reduce the penalty to a gross misdemeanor for three instead of two and a felony for four instead of three. And it came back with an explanation basically from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission that trying to bring the fiscal note down, and the response I got back was the basic point is that whenever you create a new felony offense, some small percentage of cases are going to result in prison sentences. So basically they did a shot in the dark whether there would be any felonies or not. They don't really know, and there could be anywhere from a one-bed to a three-bed fiscal impact, and they actually just don't know. A lot of these, as the investigator testified in the first committee, right now would be to start an investigation, there's no guarantee that these people would even be charged with the crime or especially with a felony. Right now, they can't even open it up on a misdemeanor investigation, at least ahead of a number of illegal documents. And the stories were told here by the reports by the officer that these people, when they come in, and these vendors and the people with the illegal documents that do this professionally actually are harder on their own low-income people and illegal immigrants. They prey on them in turn when they get here with these illegal documents. So it affects everybody across the spectrum as far as victims. And I just consider it a badly needed tool and something to further investigation and get back to these vendors get where the real crimes are. So that's my bill, and entertain any questions if you wish.
Any questions of the author? Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, based on the wording, I'm just trying to figure out the line here. So I keep my husband's, my children's, the young man that I am a legal guardian of, all of their legal documents. So I have social security numbers, birth certificates for the folks I care for. Because I would have four or five, would I be guilty of a crime under this bill?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, I've asked the legal counsel that, and I can refer to them, but line 1.16, that's one of the reasons we put without permission or lawful authority. You have to knowingly, it does any of the following. So if you had permission or lawful authority, either one, if you're carrying an ID for your son with lawful authority or you have permission with somebody else's, and I think there was probably 6 or 10 or 12 scenarios somebody can conjure up in their mind why they would have documents with them. But so that's why we put in the without permission or lawful authority. And if I could refer to Ms. Perius for the answer.
Mr. Perius.
Mr. Chair, members, I think Representative Cornish covered everything.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But what would happen is that I would technically, under the statute, be guilty of the crime, but then I would have to prove that I had lawful authority to possess those. Is that correct?
Representative Cornish.
No, Mr. Chair, remember, I don't see that. There's many laws where you could apply the same standard to say you were guilty of and had to prove that you were innocent. No, I don't believe that you would be arrested if you said you had lawful authority, unless you're talking about having to prove whether you had authority to have them or not. If an officer picked you up and found you with a handful of IDs and you said you had lawful authority and he didn't think you did, he could, further the case.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking of, folks who have different last names, for example. If, mom has a hyphenated name and the kids have a different last name and dad has a different last name and you get stopped and the officer looks and says, well, you have ID that has many different last names. What do you think would be the likely scenario?
Well, there could be any of the, I suppose, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, he could let you go and think there's nothing there. He could seize the IDs and investigate further, LOT it to the county attorney, or a number of options, I suppose. I guess it would be hard to tell based on, what the officer does or not, or what decision he makes or she.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, the school that my children went to collected the Social Security number of my children, whether they could or couldn't. There's stuff in the statute about when it's legal and when it's not. So if a school district actually accidentally collected the Social Security number for an improper purpose under the statute, would they be liable under this?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, so I understand the question. If a school district collected a Social Security number,
mm-hmm, and kept it, stored it, had possession of it, and it wasn't under the criteria under the statute, could they be liable under this?
I think it says possession of a document, so it would be possession of a Social Security card. So if they had somebody's Social Security card in their files, you're talking about?
Photocopies of them.
Knowingly had it without permission or lawful authority?
So they, I gave them the number, but under the statute they don't have the authority to collect it.
You know, it'd be a hard one for me to answer. If a school district has a Social Security card of somebody else's without authority or without permission or lawful authority, I suppose, I don't know why they would do this. But
Mr. Chair, I just bring it up because it has happened in the past. A school district has collected the information. It wasn't quite within the guidelines of the statute, and so my question is, would they be liable under this?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, in college, I had two roommates who moved out to follow the dead in the middle of term, and they just left all their stuff there, and I was sitting there with it. And I wasn't going to be able to track them down. The only way I was going to track them down is I hired a private investigator to wander through the impromptu gypsy camp outside of Albuquerque to find these two characters. And they left all their stuff there. So say cops went under my house to track these guys down or what have you, and they found all their stuff, and there are multiple different IDs. Now, I know their stuff's there. I have their stuff. It includes multiple identification documents that they own. I am certainly in possession of it because they don't live there anymore. Am I in trouble under this?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, like I said, I could probably generate six or seven more scenarios, and each one would be a case-by-case basis. First of all, it has to be two or more. It would be without permission or authority. And then the officer would have to look and see what your intent was, and if I suppose, would these be photo IDs?
Yes.
If it wasn't you, and it didn't even look like you, I suppose you'd wonder why they had him. I wouldn't think that upon that investigation that the officer would take any action if you told him that story, that report to him.
Any further questions from anyone on the committee? Excuse me, Representative Johnson. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of my concerns, Representative Cornish, is a duplication of effort, and we already know the federal government prosecutes and charges for possessing or reselling fraudulent federal documents. So why in a time of scarce resources, when we know the judiciary is overburdened, we've heard testimony from all the different courts and folks about this, would we want to pursue something that's already being done at the federal level? It doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
Oh, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, actually they aren't doing anything. There's lots of federal laws on the books, just like our immigration laws that they're ignoring. And so to rely upon the feds for a local issue, the officer testified that was here last time that couldn't be here today, that when they call in the feds, they get a 26-person team in to investigate, and that's not very popular either. They would like to have some tools to do it themselves, and rather relying on the feds for a local problem, they would rather be able to open up an investigation on their own. They've had very little cooperation with the feds as far as prosecuting under that statute that you're talking about.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've seen a letter from a federal prosecutor that indicates, in fact, they are involved in the prosecution and dealing with these fraudulent documents. So I would think that local government could, in fact, interrupt or disrupt the pursuit of a case that's being handled at the federal level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I've heard just the opposite from the local law enforcement. They would rather do the job themselves and wait for the feds to show up and take it to federal court and open up their own investigation, which is usually the reason for the investigation is how it affects the local people there. And to try to talk the federal people to come in for two or three IDs, it's a good theory, and a federal prosecutor could say they do it, but I would sure like to see how many small towns that they've been in prosecuting for two or three IDs.
Representative Johnson.
But, and again, in addition to this duplication of services, which I think is a real issue, you know, we look at the fiscal impact. It does have a significant impact on corrections, whether we're talking about supervision caseloads or prison beds at the DOC or county jail beds. And again, why we're pursuing another chargeable offense when it can be handled at the federal level is beyond me. We already are in a very fiscally tight situation. It does not seem like the right kind of bill for the kind of fiscal mess that we find ourselves in.
Got a question. Sounds like a statement, but...
Anything further from the committee? There's no further testimony. It's for the record. Oh, I apologize. Excuse me. I've just been reminded we do have further testimony. Ms. Teresa Nelson, please step forward, identify yourself, who you're with, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal counsel of the ACLU of Minnesota. We are funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Our mission is to defend the constitutional rights under the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions. And we oppose House File 152 because we believe it's unnecessary, unconstitutionally vague, and will lead to arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. This bill is unnecessary because it's duplicative of federal law that already imposes criminal penalties related to fraudulent production, use, and distribution of various identity documents. And the site for that is 18 U.S.C. Section 1028. In a time of fiscal crisis, we should be looking for solutions that enhance public safety in cost-effective ways. And duplicative criminal penalties only serve to strain already overburdened criminal justice resources. We also believe these provisions are unconstitutionally vague and violate the right to due process. This provision does not focus on intent, and so your intent may be completely lawful. You may not have an illegal intent, and yet this law could scoop you up. The bill doesn't define the term without permission or lawful authority, leaving law enforcement and individuals to really figure out, well, do I truly have lawful authority to possess my great-grandmother's birth certificate and her Social Security card? For example, consider a person who sees a wallet containing a driver's license and a military ID card that has been dropped or lost. By picking up that wallet, that person now possesses identification documents without permission or lawful authority, even though their intent might be to return that wallet to its rightful owner. With regard to Social Security numbers, I just want to make a clarification, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for bringing this issue up. Line 1.12 of the bill defines an identification document as a Social Security number or card. So it's not just the card. If you collect numbers, those Social Security numbers, that constitutes an identity document under the bill. And a lot of government agencies collect those Social Security numbers. Federal law really restricts the way in which you can do that. The Privacy Act requires certain disclosures, and it requires lawful authority. Sometimes school districts, for example, and I'm doing a study right now on a different issue, they collect that number. They don't have the disclosures that are required. They don't really have the proper authority to do it. So this bill would turn these school districts and all their employees into criminals for collecting Social Security numbers without permission or lawful authority. Likewise, data harvesters often collect material from government agencies. Government agencies, a GAO study a few years ago found that government agencies routinely fail to redact Social Security numbers. So then you have a data harvester collecting these numbers. Again, how do they show that they have collected that number with permission and lawful authority? They don't. So this bill would turn those data harvesters into criminals as well. Finally, criminalizing mere possession without intent of identification documents without permission or lawful authority will likely lead to arbitrary and discriminatory law enforcement practices. Representative Hillstrom, the police officer who stops you may not think, well, gosh, you're a criminal. I've just uncovered a criminal mastermind because you have Social Security numbers of your children and other identity documents. But oftentimes, police will have a difficult time determining whether or not some of these documents are actually genuine, especially in the immigration context. Immigration law is complex, it's very confusing, and sometimes it's very difficult to know whether or not a particular document is possessed, is genuine, number one, and is possessed with lawful authority. So this may lead to arbitrary police distinctions between people who look like they might be an illegal immigrant and people who don't. Moreover, members of Native American tribes often report that their IDs are rejected as fake because they don't look like a Minnesota driver's license. They don't have the same security. They're, a laminated card, in essence. And they report that those cards are rejected often. So a police officer who's not familiar with those various tribal ID cards may encounter a Native American who lives on the reservation who has only, you know, tribal ID as his identification, and determine that, well, everything else in his wallet is fake as well, and scoop him up, target him for arrest under House File 152. So because we believe House File 152 is unnecessary, unconstitutionally vague, and will lead to arbitrary and discriminatory law enforcement, we respectfully urge you to oppose it. Thank you.
Any questions of this witness, Representative Hillstrom, then Lesh, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said that the collection of Social Security numbers actually falls under this. So that would mean, like, credit reporting agencies that collect information that I didn't give them permission to collect, or folks like a LexisNexis, or folks that do background checks would fall under this as written?
Ms. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I believe so. And the term is without permission or lawful authority. I don't know really of, perhaps with credit bureaus, I'm not exactly sure what their specific lawful authority is to collect Social Security numbers. I know in the context of data harvesters, there's not a law out there that says that data harvesters are free to collect Social Security numbers. And that's what the more common time that it happens is, they might be collecting things from a government agency that has failed to redact that information, and they're, you know, crunching it and putting it together with other data elements. So I believe, yes, there's no exemption here for data harvesters, for others who are collecting Social Security numbers.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nelson's comments also reminded me of another question I had. As an officer in the military, I require the individual soldiers in my platoon to give me their stuff from time to time, their documents, including Social Security numbers or other identification documents as they prepare to deploy this May. Now, Representative Cornish may say, well, come on, Lesh, no one's going to arrest you or charge you with that. But I kind of still need to know, would it technically run in violation of this proposed law? Under what terms could I say that I have legal authority to possess them if the only auspices under which they gave me that document is an order from me, their officer, which would be under some vague Byzantine rule of federal law and military law? Would I potentially have to be in a position to defend myself citing military law in that instance?
Me, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I would say that if I was a company commander of a unit for a number of years, and if I was ordering people to give personal IDs to me without lawful authority, I suppose I would be in trouble. The question of lawful authority, that's why we put it in there, is if you have the authority to request them under military law, I suppose you would be okay. Not knowing what your military law is, and if you're talking, this would be in Minnesota. I suppose if you were at Camp Ripley, you would be fall under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ, whatever they say about officers taking, you know, IDs from enlisted men. I don't know.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cornish, the reason I asked that is because under what guise we consider lawful authority. I take identification documents from tenants all the time. I have drawers full of identification documents for the tenants that I rent to. I have no citation that they or proof that they gave them to me in any sense. I mean, someone walked into my house, if I didn't keep the application and say I just kept the identification documents because I forgot to hand out or keep the applications and I kept that folder, I would have tons of identification documents that I potentially forgot to throw out, and would I run in violation of this law, and how could I prove that I had done it under lawful authority?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I guess the best way to answer that is we could fill up Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory with probably an hour of talk about this and what you could or couldn't do or could be caught for, and that's why we put lawful authority or without permission. And the bottom line is it's already working in other states. that you see on your chart. The sky hasn't fallen in as the ACLU has claimed that it's going to do, and it doesn't seem to be a lot of national challenges to their law that I've heard of. And so I think that we drew the proposal in a narrow way, and to think that the people in uniform are going to come out and break down the doors of the school and charge the school principal for having two or more Social Security cards that he didn't know about is preposterous. So I think that it's a good bill. It's working in other states. We need it here, and I don't see all the concern. And there was even a person that said that when they're investigating the genealogy of his family, if he had other people's documents, he might be charged. I think we could go on and on with this, but it's working in other states, and I think it would be a good law to have here.
Got Representative Greenhagen and then Hillstrom.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish has answered quite a bit of my question already, but you know, basically the question is, of the all the examples that you heard of possible violations, is there any record of any type of arrest based on those examples that have been given or concerns in any of the other states that have this law?
Representative Cornish.
I have to answer that I haven't got into it that far to investigate, you know, to see if there were specific complaints or challenges. It's just when I'm perusing through the different sites, I haven't seen anything to that or to any note of any Supreme Court challenge or appeals or anything about these existing laws.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, anytime there is a new statute, it is our responsibility to ask questions and to find out where it could be applied inappropriately or in a preposterous way. So don't take the questions as inappropriate, because I believe that that's exactly what the committee process is for. We're supposed to be looking for who could this apply to that we did not intend for it to apply to. And as someone who, in my outside job, actually looks for the statutes when I'm presented with a set of facts to figure out whether it falls within the statute or not, I think it's really very important that we look at these genealogists, for example. You know, this doesn't say documents of a living person. And so, you know, when my sister went out and mapped my entire family so that I had a history of my family, and she photocopied the documents of people that have long since been dead in my family, possession of all of those documents, I didn't get permission from anyone who's already deceased to have them. I don't know that there's lawful authority anywhere under the statute for me to collect them or get them, but they're kind of cool to see some of those old documents and possess them. And we just need to make sure that when we're putting forward legislation that we understand the unintended consequences that sometimes flow. So that's the reason for the questions.
No problem, Mr. Chair. I didn't label your questions as inappropriate, by the way.
Any other questions? Well, seeing no further testimony and no further questions, the original motion was to have that this bill be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. At this point, the chair will lay the bill over. Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We do have the next bill, which is House File 439, and give that.
Welcome, Chairman Smith. The chair would now like to bring House File 439 before the committee. It's the intention of the chair to lay this bill over. Representative Smith, would you please move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 439, that it be recommended to pass, be referred to Committee on Public Safety, and then before you do that, I'd like you to lay it over for possible inclusion in our bill.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Please explain House File 439.
I will, Mr. Chairman and members. I have no other witnesses before me today. This bill is a rejacketing of a bill that was previously introduced in the legislature a few years ago by myself. If you, I'd refer you to Minnesota Statute 609.2232. In the past, this legislature has recognized a problem in our correctional facilities when an inmate assaults a correctional employee, a guard, whether it be assault in the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth degree, which constitutes a separate crime by itself. To add on time to the unexpired portion of the inmate's original sentence, this legislature passed 609.2232 with these words, that the assault, that the sentence imposed for the assault shall be executed and run consecutively. Now, in plain English, that means to add on the time. That was the intent of this legislature. Unfortunately, in the past few years, some of the courts have applied this statute and simply not added on time, but made it run concurrent, or, in effect, no additional penalty for that assault. So this bill was introduced telling the court system a second time what we had told them earlier, that by adding three words, shall and not concurrently, that the assault would be sentenced and sentence would be executed and shall run consecutively, not concurrently. When the bill was originally passed, it had a fiscal note. I do not have a copy of that. It was insignificant. There was a fiscal note. And when this bill was passed, this legislature dealt with that fiscal note, included that in its fiscal analysis. This bill just got lost in the last few years. I decided to bring it up again. Fiscal note's been dealt with in the past. This is a cleanup, and it's a second statement to the court that when an inmate roughs up a guard, and they get convicted of additional time, they should serve additional time.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, this basically is a bill that says we really, really mean it, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, yes.
All right. Is there anyone wishing to testify for or against House File 439? If so, please come forward. There being no further witnesses, public testimony is now closed. Is there any discussion on House File 439? Hearing no further discussion, House File 439 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. All right, members, we do have additional time scheduled, or I should say reserved for this afternoon, but we've only got one bill left, House File 2229. Representative Downey already have alerted him. We'll simply carry that bill over to Thursday. If there's any other business or questions at this time, if there are not, then it's my intent to adjourn for the day. Seeing no further action, this committee stands adjourned.